Okay, everyone, so let us continue where we left off yesterday afternoon. And so we have been looking at the path factors of right speech and right action. And maybe I should also very briefly mention right livelihood. Right livelihood is really, in a way, just an extension of the idea of right action. So you have a livelihood that kind of conforms or fits with the idea of right action. And sometimes in the suttas there are some definitions about right livelihood, but it's not talked about very much. But the general idea is that you have a livelihood, does not trade in living beings, you don't trade in weapons, in poisons, I think it is, in intoxicants, and in meat. Those are the kind of five trades that are normally mentioned in the suttas. So any trade which is kind of has a detrimental effect on living beings is considered wrong livelihood. So that's basically that one. And then when you have established yourself reasonably well in these in the morality, then from then on the next step then is to purify your mind, to work more directly with the mind itself. And this is what comes up afterwards. And this is one of the things of that sutta that we mentioned very briefly yesterday about the soil remover. The kind of gradual refinement of gold, whereby you get rid of the defilements. You start off with the coarse defilements and you go to the more refined ones. So now we're coming to the kind of medium stage defilements and how to deal with the mind directly. And this is what right effort really is all about. How to use your mind, reflect in such a way that it actually you are reducing the defilements. One of the things that always struck me when I was reading the suttas is how important reflection is. How to think about the world actually matters so much. It is not just about living a moral life, doing the right things by body and speech. It is not just about meditation practice, but it's learning to think about the world in the right way. And this comes out very nicely in a sutta which I haven't included here. It's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which says that there's two kinds of powers. And those two powers are the power of reflection on the one hand and the power of development. The power of development is the bhavana bala. But it's also the power of reflection. And this is sometimes often not really considered as part of, carefully and how you use this on the path. And the power of reflection is defined right there as the right reflection is the reflection which helps you to have the three kinds of good conduct. Good conduct by body, by speech, and by mind. So if you reflect in the right way, then these three things kind of fall into place. So in other words, all about how we think about things, to contemplate things in the right way. And then when that works out, then the morality is established in a very deep way, including also the mental morality. And then after that, that's when you have the power of bhavana, which is the meditation practice, the development of the mind. And that is defined in the suttas as the four jhanas, the seven factors of awakening. In other words, all the samadhi experiences. This is what happens in meditation practice. But anything else before that is through the power of reflection. So in other words, becoming a reasonably good person, the main way of doing that is reflection, not meditation practice. Meditation is supportive, but that is not the basis for doing morality. So that's an important point. Once you get that, you kind of start to realize that thinking, how we think about the world matters enormously. So you start to put a bit more effort into reflecting and thinking in the right way. Let us just have a quick look, first of all, in this analysis sutta, which kind of defines the idea of right effort on the path. And of course, as we have seen already, there's four right efforts, and these four are defined as follows. And what is right effort? Here one generates the desire for the non-arising of unarisen, bad, unwholesome qualities. You make an effort, you arouse energy, you apply the mind, and you strive. So straight away you can see that there is a degree of, you have to try here. You have to actually exert yourself to some extent to be able to overcome any unwholesome states. This is the non-arising unarisen. And the next one is probably more important one. Actually, they go together, really. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, bad, unwholesome qualities. So these things are very closely related to each other, because often when a bad, unwholesome quality has already arisen, you're feeling angry or upset about something, often it is too late at that point to it's very hard to give up a negative quality of mind which has established itself very strongly in you. Sometimes you just have to wait. You just have to take a breath and allow it to fade away, giving it a bit of time. So very often, a lot of the effort in overcoming the negative states happens when they are not there. Yeah, outside, when you go on the retreat, when you think about these things, when your mind is actually free of these negative qualities. Once you are trapped by these qualities, it's actually very hard to overcome them. And often you just have to be patient and allow them to fade away on their own. And one of the things that is interesting here, of course, what exactly does it mean to make an effort to arouse your energy and to apply the mind? What does that mean? And what it means in the some of the suttas we had a look at already, and also in those suttas that deal with this specifically, and we're going to see that in a second how it works, is that it has more to do with reflecting, using your inherent wisdom, if you like, to direct your mind in the right way. It does not have to do very much with using willpower. It says here you generate the will, but what kind of will is that? It's the will to reflect in the right way. It's the will to use wisdom power. It's the will to try to get out of the predicament. But it's not the will to just use mind against mind, to suppress, to, as it said before, you press the tongue against the roof of your mouth, you clench your teeth and you force things there. That is not really what is meant here. And this, you see this again and again in the suttas. It's about reflecting wisely. This is dangerous territory. This leads to my suffering, leads to the suffering of others. It leads away from the path, away from nibbana. All of these kind of things. That is the right way of thinking about this. The other aspects of the four right efforts is that you generate a desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome qualities. So it's not just about overcoming the negative, it's actually learning to think in such a way that you see the positive in people around you, you have compassion, you develop the good qualities of mind. And again, it is done through reflecting in the right way. And you generate desire for the maintenance of the arisen good qualities, for the non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. You make an effort, you arouse energy, apply the mind, and strive. This is called right effort. So it's a very general statement, because of that, it is a little bit hard to see exactly how it works out, and that's what we're going to have a look at next, is how to actually do this in a very specific case. And the case I'm going to have a look at is about how to deal with ill will, resentment it is called here, because this is by far the biggest of the mental problems. Sometimes we talk about desire, about sensual desire and these kind of things. We talk about delusion, but ill will is really number one enemy in life. It's very problematic, causes so many problems for ourselves. It's a massive obstruction in meditation, of course. And if we can just deal with that one already, we're doing something very, very useful. Dealing with sensuality is much more difficult because it is apparently attractive, and anything which is apparently attractive is much harder to overcome. Ill will, we can see quite easily, I think, most of us, why this is problematic, and for that reason it's easier to apply ourselves to overcoming this particular hindrance. And in the suttas, the Buddha always says that, not always, he says in one place that overcoming ill will is relatively easy, and also ill will is very blameworthy. One of the participants here, he had this chart that he showed me, and he showed me this chart about, the two axes. One was the ease of overcoming, and the other axis was the degree to which it was blameworthy. I think it was like that. That's what I think anyway. I apologize if I get the chart wrong. And very nice chart. Yeah, this was based on this kind of on this particular sutta, what the Buddha says: ill will, very bad, easy to overcome; sensual desire, not so bad, difficult to overcome; delusion, both bad and hard to overcome. Yeah, delusion is kind of the ultimate final thing. So, to get to delusion, we have to kind of sneak up on it. Yeah, and part of that sneaking is to first of all overcome the anger, then overcome the sensual desire, and as you do that, delusion is gradually weakened, and then you can kind of go bang, and you can eliminate delusion as well, ultimately. So you have to do things in the right sequence and know what is the best way to approach these things. So we're going to have to look at how to remove ill will, because it is the most important one, I think. And surprisingly, I think if people apply themselves in the right way to ill will, it is something that you will find that over time, if you persevere in this, if you commit to this, everyone here should be able to reduce ill will gradually over time and become like a more balanced person. And one of the things, if you are interested in developing some metta meditation, and I would, it's very useful to develop some metta. I know that many here use that as the meditation object, and that's a wonderful thing to do. But to be able to do that fully, you actually have to eliminate any kind of enmity you have towards anyone in the world. As a Buddhist, we can't really afford to have enemies. We can't really afford, ideally, to have anyone we don't like or we have some negative feelings towards. So we try to eliminate those negative feelings completely, yeah, and then the metta really starts to bite, then it really starts to work. As long as there is some enmity there, or some negative feelings towards someone, then that would block your development of the universal metta, because it would be it would be something which kind of hinders the mind in actually expanding and encompassing everything here. So very important to get this right, first of all. And it's a wonderful way to live, not to have any enemies. It's so nice when that happens. It feels like you can kind of breathe easily everywhere. There's no real issues there, no real problems. So how then do we do this? And this is what this sutta is about. This sutta is spoken by Venerable Sariputta. And he was, of course, the Buddha's right-hand monk. So sometimes when you see the statues, the iconography of the Buddha and the main disciples, you can see Venerable Sariputta. He sits like this usually here. That's how he sits. If you see this kind of posture of a monk, you know that's Sariputta. Yeah, he sits like this. Quite cool. Yeah. So that's why what he looks like on the pictures. So this is how it goes. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks. Friends, monks. Friend, those monks replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this: friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment, by which you should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. Well, that statement already is quite significant, yeah, and this idea of entirely remove resentment is not partially, it is the idea is the complete removal of resentment. This is kind of the point here, and it's arisen towards anyone. So this shows you already what this is about. It's for the complete elimination of any kind of anger or ill will, at least down the track. Of course, don't be too idealistic. These things can take time, so be reasonable about it. Don't feel bad if you can't eliminate all anger straight away. It may take time, it may take months, it may take some years. But as you see the gradual elimination, already it is powerful, already it is very useful, and you feel far better as a consequence. Okay, so what are these five? What five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So here you have five categories of people, and the reason for that is because the way to deal with them is slightly different depending on the qualities they have. This is what we will see in a second. But the five categories taken together, they represent all people. Yeah, there's no excuses. There's not kind of anyone who falls kind of outside. Everyone is included in these five categories. Which is good news. So there is no such thing as a person you cannot remove ill will towards. You can remove it towards anyone, which is great. Yeah. So there actually gives us a very powerful tool here to deal with these things. So let's have a look at each one of these in turn. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed monk sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So the idea here is basically that you shift your attention. First of all, you realize that people are complex, that they have many qualities to them. Here, Venerable Sariputta makes the distinction between bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but you can really make that distinction anywhere. Yeah, it doesn't have to be between those two. I take that just to be examples of the fact that people are complicated. Almost everyone has some slightly negative qualities, but a lot of people also have a lot of wonderful and remarkable qualities. So you are aware of that. And our minds work in such a way that very often we notice the negative things and we don't often think about the good qualities so much. Yeah, sometimes we have to kind of force our minds to see the good qualities in other people and not allow ourselves always to be irritated and be aroused by the negative qualities that we see in others. So the idea here is just you shift your attention. You learn to change your attitude towards other people. And you learn to focus on the goodness in them instead. Yeah, and because the nature of many people's minds is always to focus on the negative, we actually have to learn that as almost like a new kind of habit that we see. We focus deliberately on the good qualities in people. And to be able to do this. This is very similar to the method I called substitution before, talking about the five ways of dealing with the unwholesome thoughts. And this is like the substitution method. So you build up a perception in your mind of certain people, especially if there are certain people in your life that you find difficult, yeah, or certain people you have problems with, because this is what this is about, dealing with those people we have problems with. You build up that perception of the good qualities, and you remind yourself of that. Yeah, for example, in a group like here coming to Jhana Grove, regardless of how good everyone here is, everyone keeping the eight precepts, regardless of all the good qualities, still we allow ourselves sometimes to get irritated by our companions. Why? Because when you live close together, it's always a little bit of friction, always disagreements. We have different perceptions about how to behave, how to be courteous, how to do the right thing. And because our perceptions are different in these areas, we always rub up against each other in a certain way, to some degree. It's very, very hard to avoid that. So don't try to avoid that. It's almost impossible. But instead, remind yourself of the big picture. Yeah, here, okay, I don't understand the minds of the people around me 100%. In fact, that is almost impossible. It's not to be expected. But what I know is that all of these people who are here on this retreat, many people here you probably never met before even, you know that they are good people. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here. What's the point of coming to Jhana Grove and living on eight precepts, meditating you know, for several hours a day, listening to kind of beautiful teachings by the Buddha. What's the point of doing that unless you are committed to something very positive? It's madness to come here if you are kind of some dodgy character, isn't, you know. You know for certain that the people who are here, they are very, very good people. So remind yourself of that. You build that up into an image of the people around you. And then when a small irritation arises, you quickly shift your mind back to that image of knowing that these people actually are not really worthy of being criticized for this tiny little thing. It's a small little thing. The big picture is so beautiful, you remember the big picture. Yeah, and this is really how this works. You build up that image inside of you, and when you do that, you overcome the little negative things in life. But to be able to do this, you have to apply yourself a little bit. And this is what is meant here with the right effort. You give rise to, generate desire, yeah, you generate the energy, and you apply the mind. This is what it really means. You apply the mind to build up this alternative perception. And then you take that off the shelf in your mind. You've got all these perceptions on the shelf in your mind. You take it down to counteract any negative that may arise. It's very powerful. And actually, it's not that hard to do if you commit to this sort of practice, this way of doing things. So, and this is also what you do in monastic life. Yeah, in monastic life, you live with people for many, many years at the time. And again, of course, when you live with people for a long period of time, very often you have the same kind of little bit of friction happening sometimes. So remind yourself of the big picture. And when you do that, it's actually relatively easy to let go and to let go of the minor problems, etc. So this is the basic idea behind this, yeah, and it is a very powerful thing if you get this sort of thing right. Now, what is interesting about this, and of course we try then this not just with people here, but anyone in our lives where we can see substantial good qualities, you can use this particular technique. Now, one of the interesting points when we talk about this thing is that people often say, but is this being realistic? Yeah, if you always focus on the good qualities, isn't the point of Buddhism to be realistic? Isn't the point to see the world as it actually is? If I just focus on the good qualities in someone, I'm kind of ignoring half of reality. Well, not half, or 10% of reality or whatever. Shouldn't I see the whole picture of this person? And the answer to that, there's a couple of answers there. The first one is that if someone has negative qualities, well, if you can look at those qualities as well, then you know you will have to know how to deal with that without that giving rise to negative qualities in your mind. And that is through using compassion. We'll have a look at that later on. But the more important point is to remember that people's character are inherently unknowable to us. And it's not only inherently unknowable to us, but it's even unknowable to the person who has that character, because a character is not fixed. A character is always fluctuating. Two people can look at the same person, have widely different ideas about the qualities in that person. Yeah, why? Because they have seen different aspects of that person. And because there is no inherent essence in that person, they aren't this way or that way, and because we are anyway unable to even ascertain what is already there, there is nothing really to there is no reality you can focus on. There is no objective truth to say that this is the way this person is. They're always changing, and all we do is see certain qualities in that person at particular times. So because there is no objective reality, and because there is nothing really to there is no thing as they actually are. In this case, when we talk about the way things actually are, we talk about general principles of nature, like impermanence and suffering. This we can talk about because these are general principles, but not the character of a person. So instead of asking ourselves, what is a person like? How can we analyze the person in the right way? How can we see them as they actually are? Instead, the right way of approaching this is to ask ourselves, what is the way of looking at people that is helpful for developing the path? That is what we should ask instead. See, we are deliberately avoiding looking at the negative qualities, knowing that we cannot inherently know a person anyway. So what we're going to do instead is just to look at the good qualities and focus on that. Why? Because it is supportive for the development of the path. That's why we do that. So forget about the idea of seeing people rightly here. Yeah, it can't be done anyway. Instead, remember, this is a good way of learning how to develop our own mind and develop our own path. And down the track, you also learn to see the qualities more broadly, but you take into, you use different methods to be able to see that. In the meantime, focus on the metta, focus on seeing the good sides of things. And from seeing the good qualities in people, that is where metta arises. Yeah? Ill will arises when you see the negative quality. Metta arises from seeing the good qualities of others. Yeah, you see, you become very happy when you see good qualities in other people, if you do it in the right way. And then you wish them well, because you feel positive towards them. And then the metta arises from that. Okay, so then we have this beautiful simile here. Yeah, let's just read out the simile that goes with this. And this is the simile of the ragged robe monk who sees a rag by the roadside. Yeah, so if you look at some of the monks in our monastery, they also have rag robes, and they look very colorful, and it looks like the robes are going to fall off a little bit. If you are, you know, trying to live a little bit like a forest monk, you take a little bit of pride in having a robe that is a little bit kind of, you know, not super duper, but kind of looks as if it's I don't know, plucked off the charnel ground or something like that. And if you kind of take a little bit of happiness in that and kind of living very simply. I used to have one of those rag robes myself, and I used to travel around the world in my rag robe. And sometimes people really looked at me and wondering, what is this fellow? What is he doing? And then I felt really proud of myself when people looked at me like that. I was very happy with that. Of course, rag robe monk sees a rag by the roadside, very happy, yeah, rag, yay, okay. So he, and then he, what he does, he goes over to that rag, you press it down with your left foot, yeah, you spread it out with your right foot, and you tear off the intact section, because you want to get the good part of that rag, the part which is usable, not the part which I kind of, you know, getting rotten and very soiled or whatever. And in the same way, when you see another person, it's almost as if you kind of spread out all the qualities in your mind's eye. Yeah, you think of all the qualities, the various types of qualities, the bad ones, the good ones, the ones in between, and you look at the whole person like that. Yeah, and then when you look at the whole person like that, you take all the bad qualities, you tear them off. Yeah, throw them out. Why do you throw them out? Because you know that these qualities are rubbish. They are bad. They only conduce to suffering. You can't use them for sewing them into your robe. You can't use them for, you can't really integrate them into your mind unless you want to suffer a lot. And then you take the remaining good qualities, just like you take that remaining cloth, you take those qualities into your heart. Yeah, and you bring them around with you. And because you take them into your heart, you take them into your memory, you produce this image of this person. Whenever the negative qualities start to arise in your mind, you bring it out again. Yeah, and then you sew the patch onto your robe or whatever, and then you overcome that negative thought using it. So carry around with you in your heart this quality. It's a nice way of thinking about how to kind of deal with this kind of situation. And then you take it with him, yeah, which is carrying it with you. So this is the kind of the beautiful little simile here about how to take these qualities, the good ones, and bring them with you in your life. There's a story I always tell at this particular point, because it's a nice little story. Many of you will have heard it before, but it's a nice little story from the Vinaya. The Vinaya has many things that many people have never heard of before, because not so many people read the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the code of conduct and the monastic law, yeah, the law that monastics follow. And in that Vinaya, there's lots of little stories, stories about what happened at the time of the Buddha and afterwards. And this is a story about this rag robe monk. Yeah, this is just a bit of entertainment. Yeah, because otherwise, I don't want things to get too dry. So, so there is a story about this rag robe monk. And of course, as I said, when the rag robe monk sees a rag, he's very happy. And one of the places where they would find rags in those days would be at the charnel grounds. A charnel ground is a place where you burn the corpses, yeah? You put the corpse out, and after a few days, you burn them. Kind of ancient way of getting rid of corpses. They still use it today in certain countries. I know Ajahn Brahm tells of when he was in the northeast of Thailand, the monastery, Wat Nanachat, they had a charnel ground, and they would just build up a big kind of pyre, you know, funeral pyre of lots of wood, and they would just put the corpse on top, and they would just burn the whole thing up. Yeah? It's quite interesting, isn't it? Kind of this burning the corpse right there in the open, right in front of your eyes. That's before they had crematoriums. This is the original crematorium, perhaps. So this monk, the story of this monk, is that he came to the charnel ground, yeah? And there he saw a fresh corpse. And of course, so happy, fresh corpse, because the corpse would always be wrapped in a little bit of cloth. So the monks would then go and they would take the cloth off the corpses. Is that nice? Is that a good idea? So you can imagine, if you're going to take the cloth off a corpse, it's got to have to be reasonably fresh, yeah? If you leave it too long, it's going to be absolutely disgusting. So you have to take it fairly soon. Unfortunately for this particular monk, this corpse was really, really fresh. So he'd start taking the cloth off, and as he does so, this corpse kind of comes to life and says, "Do not take my cloth." Imagine that. Whoa, wait. It kind of freaks you out a little bit, yeah? But this monk, he is very determined. He is a rag robe monk. He really needs this cloth. So he ignores the corpse, yeah? So he takes off the cloth, and then he kind of starts walking off, and the corpse is really upset. So the corpse gets up and starts walking behind him, yeah? And so this, I think, this is the origin to the zombie movies. That's what I reckon, yeah? I mean, here, this is a real zombie walking behind this monk. So then, of course, what happens then is that the monk, he kind of starts, "Whoa, wait a minute, this is scary," and kind of runs off, and he runs back to his cute, he slams his door, and then just as he slams the door, the corpse kind of falls over on the outside, the energy being depleted, yeah? So that is one of those stories that you find in the Vinaya and in the suttas, and very quite interesting. And I think then the Buddha lays down the rule, yeah? And the rule that he lays down is that you should not take cloth from a corpse that is still warm. You should wait till a corpse at least has cooled down a little bit, then you can take the cloth. Otherwise, there may still be a sense of ownership there, yeah, from the actual corpse. That's the rule which comes out of that. So you can see the monastic rules are very interesting and quite broad and varied. So for those of you who are thinking of becoming a monastic, I'm not sure exactly who you are, these are the kind of rules you have to keep, yeah, when you become a monastic. So keep that in mind. Anyway, that is that story of the rag robe monk. But the idea here really is just the beautiful idea of taking the good qualities of someone, taking them into your heart and carry them with you in your mind. So they are ready to be used like a protective shield or like a weapon. Remember before we had the idea of loving kindness as a weapon? Remember that? One of the very first suttas we were talking about. Goodwill, compassion, and these things as a weapon. And because they protect you against these negative qualities. So you carry them with you and use them at the right time and the right place. So that is the first of these five ways. And in many ways, it is the most important one. Number two. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you have almost a completely parallel case to the previous one. Yeah, the idea here now, they've just changed around bodily and verbal behavior. The idea is just that people are different. people also change. Sometimes they may have certain good qualities, later on they may have different good qualities. You may have to look at that person differently depending on time and place. The main difference here is the simile, and this is another very beautiful simile in my opinion. You have the idea of the pond covered with algae and water plants. And of course the pond here is the simile for the person. Yeah, the person who is covered with algae and water plants, they have some negative qualities. The algae and water plants are the negative qualities in that person. And all the good qualities, which is the clean water underneath, are kind of covered up. You can't really see them because you are focusing too much on the negative qualities. Then this man comes who is afflicted and oppressed by the heat. Yeah, or a person comes, maybe better, afflicted and oppressed by the heat. And of course, being afflicted and oppressed by the heat means that you are basically, you are angry. Yeah, this is what, you are hot, you are heated inside, and you are oppressed. This is what ill will and anger really is all about. And you are weary because anger tires you out. But also, and this is kind of the interesting part, in a sense you are thirsty. You are looking for a solution to that anger, trying to find a way out of it. And of course that is the significant issue here. You're not just buying into it, but trying to find a way out. So then what do you do? Well, what you do is that when you come to this pond, you sweep away the algae and the water plants. Yeah, you know that these negative qualities just have to be swept out. You can't really follow those. And then when you sweep, after you sweep them away, then you drink with your cupped hands. The beautiful water underneath, the delightful qualities in that person, you literally imbibe them into your mind. You drink them up, yeah? And you kind of, because you drink them up, you of course, then you carry them with you afterwards as a consequence. So you drink up the good qualities. It's a nice metaphor for thinking about how we look at other people. And of course, then you absorb that, whereas all the negative things, the algae and the water plant, you sweep it away because you know it is useless. It is rubbish in a sense. So just another metaphor, another simile for how to look at this idea of taking on board the good qualities while getting rid of the bad ones. Otherwise, the ideas here are basically the same as the previous one. Okay, third one. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted, oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. And so he does just that. He gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here, what we have is we have a person who has not so many good qualities. Yeah, some good qualities, but not so many. And here it is, these small amount of good qualities, they are likened to the opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. What exactly does that mean? And opening of the mind, opening here is the Pali word is vivarana. And vivarana is the opposite of the nivarana. The nivarana are the five hindrances, yeah? And the five hindrances are the things that cloud your mind, that make you unable to see clearly. The vivarana is the exact opposite of that, when the mind is largely free of those hindrances and you have some clarity. So the mind opens up, yeah? And it becomes becomes beautiful. And it gives you access to samadhi, gives you access to basic meditation, like watching the breath and all of that. So you have a mind that is liberated and free from all these oppressing things. And because it is free of the hindrances, it is also placid. Placid means like the water is flat, it's calm, it is tranquil and beautiful, like a beautiful lake in the same way. Yeah, so, and this is one of those interesting things in life, that sometimes people may have a lot of negative qualities, but they may have an area where they have small good qualities. In this case, it is quite surprising, because here, the way he's phrasing this is like, you have bad bodily action, bad speech, but still somehow you gain some inner good qualities at the very least. Yeah, this is what I was talking about the other day, how sometimes people are so complex, people are so different. Yeah, externally they may come across as very kind of difficult or whatever, but internally, because of past karma, because of past habits or whatever, they're still able to access good meditation. And this is why sometimes you need to be careful, as we said, with how you judge other people, because people are complex. So you look at people very carefully, and when you look at them carefully, you can see these small areas of good qualities, even if they are just internal to themselves and very hard to see from the outside. This is what this is about. Please don't think, sometimes people think, oh, it's really unfair, you know, this scallywag gets good meditation where I don't get good meditation at all. Don't think like that, because a person who acts like this, who has bad speech and bad bodily behavior, in the long run, they're going to drag themselves down. Eventually, they will lose that clarity of mind, they will lose the calm, and they will lose their meditative abilities, whereas you will be on the rise, you will be doing all the right things, and eventually, you will get there where that person was before. So they are on the way down, whereas you are on the way up, yeah? And of course, what is important in the world is not what you have. It is what you do with what you have. It is where you are going that matters, not so much where you are. If you're going in the right direction, eventually all of these things will come to you. So remember that. The Buddhist path is about improving. It's not about where we are. It's about improving. It's about moving in a certain direction. As long as you are improving, then you are fulfilling the path. It doesn't matter where you are. Don't worry about where you are, because if you do, you only drag yourself down and feel bad about yourself sometimes. Whether you are improving is really the important issue here. But because there's only a few good qualities, you have to be very careful how you look at this person. You can't look too far to one side or too far to the other side. You have to be like the cow that drinks from a puddle. Yeah, very focused. Don't stir things up by looking to the left, looking to the right. Focus very squarely on those few good qualities. And then you are able to have metta towards that person as well. And sometimes it's true, isn't it? Sometimes it is marvelous that people have even small good qualities in this world. Sometimes the world kind of is so harsh and so difficult to deal with, and people get, you know, sometimes have very difficult lives sometimes. There's all these things going on, and it's wonderful to celebrate the little bit of goodness that is actually found in people, even though they may be difficult in so many ways. It's a very beautiful way of looking at people. Of course we can expect people to have bad qualities, but the fact that they actually often have good qualities as well, that is worth celebrating. This is kind of the right way of looking at this. So one of the interesting things about this is that what you can see here is how far the Buddha, or Venerable Sariputta in this case, how far they stretch this idea of seeing the good qualities in people. Yeah, you take that to a very almost as far as you possibly can, searching for the good qualities, looking at that. And only the next one, which comes up next, is where you cannot see any good qualities, and then you have to have a different approach for how to deal with those kind of people. So why is it that the Buddha does that? Why, assuming that this comes from the Buddha originally, why do we try so hard to see the good qualities in people rather than using compassion or whatever else? And I think the reason for that is that, I think I mentioned this before already, metta, seeing the good qualities, can never really go wrong. You can't go wrong with that, because seeing the good in others always leads to wholesome results as a consequence. But karuna, compassion, is very easy to kind of see the suffering in other people and see the problems. And if you're not careful, it can lead to kind of a negative mind state, a heaviness, seeing all the suffering in the world. And actually, it becomes painful rather than being a positive thing. So with karuna, with compassion, it's actually more difficult to get the balance right. It's not as easy. Metta is always going to be positive. Karuna is more difficult. And that's why I think the Buddha emphasizes the idea of metta so much, because it is always right, is always going to lead in the right direction. But sometimes it turns out to be impossible. Yeah, sometimes there are people in the world where we just cannot see the good qualities. They're just too much coming in, and it was very hard for us to be able to separate out the good qualities in that person. And that is where the fourth method here comes into play and becomes an important one. So before I even start looking at this, one of the things to remember when we use compassion in this way, and when all we see is bad qualities in someone else, one of the things to always remember about this is that even though all we see is bad qualities in a person, again, we cannot really see into their minds. We don't actually know what their minds are like. We don't actually know what the person is like. It is our subjective view of that person is that they have no good qualities. But we don't actually know that. Yeah, so straight away, it is good to have a degree of humility when you see bad qualities in someone else. Actually, we don't really know. It is just the way they look at us, look to us right now. And if you have that little bit of degree of humility about your own ability to see people properly, it means that you allow them the possibility to change in the future. If you put them in the box of bad people, yeah, I'm just going to have compassion for you. It already sounds a bit dodgy, doesn't it? But if you do that, you don't really allow the possibility of change. You will change. You will see things differently. They will change, yeah? And because of this, you are allowing that to happen and giving them the opportunity to have metta towards them in the future. And this is always so important. Yeah, when we deal with people, we should always give them that benefit, that possibility of changing, of becoming someone else. Not kind of kind of defining them too narrowly. This is who they are, and kind of you finished with that person. But always be flexible in our attitude, allowing that movement with things. I think this is very important. Otherwise, we trap people. We trap people in their so-called station in life, not giving them the chance to grow. Yeah, if everybody sees you in a certain way, you start to believe that yourself and you become trapped. If other people give you the opportunity to grow, you feel you are allowed to grow and change. And because of that, that is often what happens as a consequence. How we look at other people actually affects other people enormously. If we look at people with seeing the good qualities, seeing the potential for change, we are actually supporting that change and supporting the good qualities in other people. It's not a beautiful gift to give to others, you know? Very nice gift to give, support people in their growth. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. Anyway, so this is what happens when... this is how we deal with this, yeah? How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time? So this is the person with bad qualities all the way through. Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him or them and the next village ahead of them were both far away. They would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. They would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway would see them and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for them, thinking, "Oh, may this person obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May they get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here." So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for them, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May they abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May they abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior." For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, they will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. And so here you are, again, this person who you cannot see any good qualities in. You should regard them as someone who is ill, someone who is sick, yeah, someone who is kind of heading towards disaster and calamity because they have no idea what they are actually doing to themselves by behaving in this way. And this is a kind of such a beautiful way of turning the tables, if you like. Usually, if someone is very difficult with us, yeah, and we find that they are doing all kind of bad things towards us, it is very natural to become upset about that. But the reason we become upset is because we take it personally and we feel that they are doing this against us. What right have they to do bad things against us? We haven't done anything towards them, so why are they doing bad things towards us? And it's this personality thing, this feeling that they are acting to us, that is what kind of makes it problematic. It's personal in a sense. But remember, and this is kind of the point here, and I've already talked about this quite a bit before, but remember the point is that it is not personal. Yeah, this person, they are acting according to their own inner demons, their own inner conditioning, and that is just playing out. You happen to be the wrong person at the wrong time in the wrong place, and because of that you have to bear the brunt of that. It's got nothing to do with you at all, it's only got to do with them. It is their way of acting. They have the problem, you don't actually have a problem. And once you see that, once you change your focus, instead of focusing on you, you know, I have to bear all these problems, and instead look at the other person and see that they are the one who has the problem. You are changing around 180 degrees. Focus on this in a very, very different way. And because you are, if you are able to do that, what happens is that you start to have compassion for people who are, who do bad things in this way. So it's a very powerful thing to be able to do. Of course, it is often difficult, because often our perceptions of others get stuck, and it's hard to do these things. So don't expect yourself to be able to do this necessarily straight away or fast. Depends also on what kind of relationship you have with people, yeah? So don't feel bad about yourself if you can't do this with some people. Just start out with what you have and see if you can move even a little bit in that direction. And if you can move a little bit in that direction, you're already doing what you can. And that is really what matters. And gradually, 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 perhaps you will be able to unravel this and resolve it in a good way down the track. But you can see what is happening here. What is happening is that everyone wants to be happy. Well, everyone wants to live in peace. Everyone wants to do things that lead to their own happiness and well-being in the long run. Even people who do bad things, they do the bad things because they think it is positive for them. Yeah? If you are born in some kind of, as I mentioned before, a kind of mafia family, yeah, you think that by doing bad things you will please your family, that will lead to happiness or whatever, whatever. It is completely deluded, of course, but that is what you think. And of course, this is precisely the problem. Someone who wants to be happy, who thinks they are doing what will lead to happiness, actually, they are doing the exact opposite. They're doing things that lead to their own suffering in the long run. They are blind. They are deluded. They're walking around in darkness, having no idea how the world actually works. And because of that, because they think they're creating happiness for themselves, because they want happiness, but actually, they are creating enormous suffering for themselves, then when you see that, you think, oh, actually, compassion is the right approach for this person. This is how you then turn the tables around and you look at people in a different way. So the person who is badly behaved, They are sick. Yeah, they are blind. They are deluded. They don't know what they're doing. And then things change. Your perception starts to change. And then you can start to see how there is no one in this world you cannot have some kind of compassion towards. At the very least, compassion. Or at the very least, like a neutral mindset. Yeah. After you develop this perception for a while. That is what you do when you cannot see any good qualities and when all you see are the negative qualities. These things are very powerful, yeah, very, very useful things to develop in your life. And as you do so, you will start gradually to see things will change. And what a wonderful thing it is to see change in yourself. This is beautiful things and one of the most encouraging things when you start to see that change in your perception, in the way you look at people. It's very, very encouraging because you really start to see how powerful this path is and how it actually enables you to change, to be more wholesome, to align your attitudes with the Dhamma and all these kind of things. Okay, let's come to the very last person here. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? So this is like the saint almost. Yeah, this is the person who is kind of pure in all conceivable ways almost. Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, a delightful place, shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to the pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So this is the person who is perhaps an Arya or a noble one or someone who is practicing really well, gaining good samadhi. And of course, it includes people like arahants and all of these. They are included in that. And of course, one of the points that straight away comes out of this is that even if someone is very pure, still people get angry with them. Yeah, the Buddha, people got angry with the Buddha, people get angry with arahants, and this just shows you that sometimes we cannot really trust our perceptions 100%. Yeah, so again, this idea that we are, it makes you a little bit more humble about your perceptions and about how you judge other people when you remember that. And here, it is very easy, yeah, it is very simple to deal with that, because if you are angry, then you can't, when you come to this pond, there is no algae there anymore. There's no water plants to be swept away. All there is this beautiful, clear, sweet, and cool water. And as you, when you get there, even though you are angry, you just dive into it. You plunge into that pond. And then you bathe. You cool down. You drink in all those wonderful qualities. And then the interesting thing here is that after you come out, you sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. It is almost as if the presence of the other person is delightful. Here you realize that you are in the presence of someone special. You realize you are in the presence of someone who maybe has understood these teachings in a deep way. And you realize that actually you should stay in the vicinity. You should take a person like this as your Kalyana Mitta. You hang out in the shade of the trees right there. You don't go anywhere else. You become perhaps even a disciple of this person. This is perhaps the Buddha. You become even a disciple. You become a student of them. And you follow them around as a consequence. Yeah, so this is kind of the wonder here when you find the right kind of people. And this is why it says here at the very end of the sutta, or it says that you, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. Yeah, when you see someone like that, confidence arises. And this is one of those interesting little things in the Dhamma that, it is important to have sometimes people in our lives that we feel inspire confidence in us. Sometimes it's good to meet people who you feel have a certain presence, a certain ability to live the Dhamma, who kind of exemplify the Dhamma through their conduct, through their speech, through their art, through who they are. It's very useful, because when you see that, it gives rise to this vision of an alternative possibility of seeing the world in a different way. Yeah, and it says in the sutta somewhere, it says that sometimes just seeing an arahant, seeing someone who is perfectly enlightened, is actually a massive benefit in your life, because you see something else. You see an alternative possibility. You don't have to be mired in suffering all the time. It is possible to get out of anger. It is possible to be selfless, yeah, to a very, very high degree. You see that right there with your own eyes, and that can have a very, very powerful impact. Remember, I mentioned the other day about Venerable Sariputta, who met Venerable Asaji. And then he just saw him, and he realized this person is different. And then, of course, he had the same kind of experience himself soon afterwards. So that already is very, very, very useful. So one of the great things about the Buddhist teachings, I think, is that we have these ancient scriptures. We have the Buddha, who everyone respects. So in one way, we're all on the same level. We're all students or disciples of the Buddha. And at the same time, while we have those ancient scriptures and we're all looking to the same place for guidance, we also have still living examples in the present day of people who actually practice these teachings all the way to the end of the path. And that double thing is actually incredibly powerful. If you haven't got the living example, the scriptures become like dry and it's hard to kind of get inspired in the same way. If you haven't got the scriptures, you just have the example. Well, then you have like these kind of maverick spiritual teachers and you don't really know whether they are on solid ground, whether they are following a real path or not. When the two come together, it is actually often very, very powerful. And that is what we have in Buddhism, and is one of the things that make this Buddhist teaching so powerful and so unique. Anyway, there you are. That is how to deal with ill will and anger. There are other things that could be said about this, but I think that is already quite a lot and quite useful. And I would recommend you to take these teachings very seriously. Remember that when you purify your mind, you don't just purify your mind. Actually, your speech and your conduct becomes part of that process as well. Because when your mind is pure, obviously how you express yourself also is purified as a consequence of that. So very, very useful teachings, in my opinion, and usually applicable to the vast majority of people. Anyway, so that is all for this morning, and we'll see you back again at 3:00 this afternoon.